Welcome to The Property Wizard. If you are brand new to the real estate investment world or have limited experience, you've come to the right place. Freddie Crouch has over 35 years of real estate investing experience. He's seen it all, and he's ready to share it with you. This podcast takes an inside look at investing in real estate, what to look for, and most of all, how to move forward. Please welcome the property wizard, Freddie.
Welcome, everybody. Great to have you back with us. Today, we've got a special show. We're going to do our season one wrap-up. We're going to discuss some of the finer points about podcast episodes 1 through 12. Once again, I'd like to thank Nathan Simon for that great tune. Nathan is part of the team at Carl Speaks, which is headed by no other than podcast guru Carl Richards. I know Carl's getting a little tired of me referring to him as a podcast guru, but if the shoe fits, wear it. To round off the team, the cover artwork has been provided by Carolyn Nikolai. And I'd like to thank everyone for the wonderful effort for season one of The Property Wizard. So, Bernie, this is going to be a little different for us. Let's just have an open, candid discussion about the first 12 episodes. No mailbag today, no in the news. Just you and I making a lot of noise. So what I'd like to, you know, let our listeners know is that just before we started our podcast recording, Bernie and I were going over some of the stats. And I am tickled pink to be able to tell our listeners that we are truly international podcast. We have listeners throughout the U.S., across Canada, in Europe, Australia, and even in Africa. What do you think of that, Bernie? Would you have ever thought?
It's a good far reach. And you know what? It just goes to show that real estate is real estate, even though the rules governing it are local, you know, to the province or state that you're in. But, you know, the principles are the same everywhere. If you look at your course that goes into more depth into these topics, it applies everywhere. Because you know what? A mortgage is a mortgage.
Absolutely true. You know, and we talked a lot about leverage, about how leverage is really the key to successful real estate investing. And all we're referring to there is the fact that leverage allows you to get the benefit of the appreciation of an asset in its entirety, even though you have not or do not have the total value of that asset in equity in the property. And I know that sounds very, very convoluted, but at the end of the day, there isn't another investment where you can put down a relatively small percentage of the value of that investment, have others pay for it, and also benefit by the appreciation of the asset as a whole. That's what we call about leverage. And it is really a concept which is difficult to duplicate in just about any other investment, period. Does that make any sense to you?
It does. Well, it's like even if you buy a car, right? Its value diminishes over time. That's not the same with property. Mind you, if you don't take care of the property, other issues, but, you know, things appreciate in value. Even the housing market right now, you can see that, you know, where a house a year ago, it might have been worth maybe $500,000. All of a sudden, now it's $800,000 because the market demands.
So that's a great point, Bernie. But of course, unlike an automobile, which is a depreciating asset, real estate generally appreciates. Now, like I've always said, you don't want to count on that appreciation. It's something that's not written in stone. But generally, the trend over time is for your asset to appreciate. Now, depending on how long you have your asset, it could be by a couple of percentage points, or it could be by, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50%. It just depends on a number of different factors and the length of time that you own the asset. So, keeping that in mind, the magic about real estate is that you can leverage your investment. You can take a relatively small amount of money as far as, you know, when I say small, I mean representative to the total value of your purchase or the asset itself, And what you'll see is you'll see appreciation on value of the asset as a whole, not just on that portion you've put down, but appreciation on the total value of the asset. Not just that, but you have others paying and increasing your equity every month. Doesn't matter whether it's a commercial property, doesn't matter whether it's a multifamily property, or whether it's a single family home. What happens is every month you have others, your tenants, paying and increasing your equity. That's the second point. There isn't another asset that does that. There's none. There's no asset where you can, first of all, buy it, leverage your investment so that you have control and ownership of the asset as a whole, and where you have others paying and increasing your equity. That's the magic of it. That's why there hasn't been any other form of investment that has created more multimillionaires than real estate. Now, I know in today's market, multimillionaires doesn't sound like, you know, a great accomplishment, but let's put things in the right perspective. I mean, I say multimillionaires, shall we say, you know, even billionaires to some aspect, but a lot of very, very successful families, investors, have a sizable portion of their portfolio in real estate. And there's a good reason for it, for the very reasons that we've discussed. Well, I had a discussion last week with a gentleman, an older gentleman, who just divested himself of several multi-unit residential buildings that he owned. And he was really quite curious about our co-tenancy program and wanted to know how he could get involved. And in that particular case, we had a rather, again, candid discussion, and we talked about what his interests were and where he saw himself in another 5-10 years, and the reason for him wanting to invest in real estate in the first, I mean, not in the first place. You have to remember he owned real estate for a long time, but as it came out, of course, real estate is cyclical in nature, and very seldom do you see all facets of real estate investment increase in value at the same rate at the same time. So one thing about investing in a co-tenancy is it allows you to spread out your investment dollars into different areas. You know, you may decide to invest in a duplex or a single family, and then buy a small retail plaza, maybe get involved in some sort of land banking, but it allows you to take a small amount of your investment dollars and diversify that. And there's a great deal of wisdom in diversification because you spread the risk out. For instance, and I think we use the example of having to replace a boiler in a commercial building or a high rise. You know, that can cost at the low end $35,000, $40,000. It could cost $100,000, $150,000. Just depends on a lot of different issues. But it's far easier for the average investor. Let's say it costs $100,000, but let's say you also have 9 other partners besides yourself. It's far easier for you to contribute $10,000 towards the replacement of that boiler system than it is to ask you to write a check for $100,000. It's not any more mystical or magical than that. At the end of the day, you're spreading the risk out, whether it's one property or 10 properties. And I constantly, you know, tell our listeners that diversification via co-tenancies is a wonderful and brilliant way to turn around and expand your real estate portfolio. So I think after you look at all the different options available to you, co-tenancy is a wonderful way to do it. But then we also spoke about in types of real estate investments. We spent some time talking about single family homes. A lot of times, Bernie, and I know you can vouch for this, we get questions from people that are saying or asking us, what should I do first? Should I buy a single family home for us to live in? Or should I take those monies and buy investment real estate? I've always said, do both. Don't necessarily buy 2 different properties, but if you're at a stage of your life where you feel that a single family home is something that you're going to make use of, by all means, it's a fantastic first investment. But look at that property and have it work for you. For instance, you know, you may want to rent out a room. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that at all. renting out a room is quite commonplace. And today, when there's a real lack of affordable apartments, you'd be surprised how readily you'll be able to find a tenant. Or you can finish the basement, or not finish the basement. Maybe you might want to rent out the lower level or a floor. You're allowed to do that. And in a lot of jurisdictions, what a lot of people don't realize is that you can put or have an in-law suite in your home. And as long as you don't put in a full kitchen, and by that I mean a stove and an oven, in a lot of jurisdictions, that's okay. You don't need to completely undergo a fire retrofit. Now, having said that, of course, we're also very strong advocates to make sure that you do everything necessary to ensure the safety of not just your tenant, but yourselves, particularly if you're sharing a home. So, of course, you want to make sure that you've got working carbon monoxide and smoke detectors and make sure there are proper ways of egress, regardless of what the local bylaws say. Always better to be more confident in the arrangements that you've made as far as protection is concerned than just doing the bare minimum.
The other part I think we raised during that time was investment clubs and setting those up as a place to pool people, not so much for their money, but to get to know them. And then it might be a resource, which we'll kind of talk about a little later on, but even other people to understand what's available out there. What are the opportunities? Because it's not like it's on a shelf in a superstore where you walk in, or Costco, where you walk in and go, hey, there's what I need. I need extra rolls of toilet paper. It's not like it's always available that way. Those are opportunities that come up. They just show up on their own steam, right?
Investment clubs are a great way to get to know your fellow investors and to find out about what other opportunities there may be out there. There's lots of sources. I mean, you know, if you're interested in a particular neighborhood, I mean, subscribe or pick up the local, you know, e-news that maybe the community issues, or, you know, newspaper, or, you know, listen and talk to your neighbors. I mean, you'd be really amazed at how much information you can find out by simply walking around the neighborhood. So look for opportunities, listen to what your neighbors are saying, find out what the local municipality is planning down the road, not just immediately, but maybe look at the official plan. But investment clubs are a great way to put together family, friends, to talk about what your interests are, the type of property you may want to invest in, find out what the investment level that everybody feels comfortable in. It's a wonderful way to get the ball rolling. And you know, again, behind that is if you have one person who has a little more experience, or maybe if you don't, invite a local realtor, invite someone who maybe has the experience to kind of walk you through the process. It doesn't have to be that complicated. And, you know, you get to start building your team. And I think we talked about that a little later on when we talked about, you know, property management, about the importance of having your team and being able to, you know, reach out to those that have the answers for you. And I think that's what we really tried to do during the first 12 podcasts, is really touch on a lot of different points, you know, with a lot of different professionals, all with the idea that these folks can help you invest in your first property. So yeah, investment clubs, brilliant idea. Friends and family, you know, listening and watching the local news, walking the neighborhood, talking to, you know, other people that should know, like real estate agents, like maybe your lawyer. You know, these are all very valid ways of just finding out what's happening. And, you know, everybody loves talking about real estate. Everybody does. It doesn't matter where you are. Everyone loves talking about real estate. So, you know, the whole idea, and you know what I always expound on, Bernie, you know, I say real estate deals are like streetcars, you know, a new one's coming around the corner every 15 minutes. The key is finding out which streetcar to get on to get you to where you want to go. So I know that's a mouthful, but it's true. There's lots of opportunities out there, lots of them. So make your real estate investment work for you, and it'll work for you. Even if you're buying your first home, you can make that asset work for you.
I guess this is going to lead us into raising investment dollars then. How do you raise funds, right? We talked about investment clubs. Yeah, maybe you should look at how do we recruit new members if you're setting up an investment club.
I think generally speaking, when you're first starting, word of mouth is probably the best type of, well, advertisement. Can we call it advertisement? But again, as I mentioned earlier, everybody loves talking about real estate. You can take a conversation that starts off rather innocently about, you know, what's happening in your local market and turn it into a discussion about maybe joining an investment club, you know, to, you know, take advantage of current market trends or even as a form of just investment strategy, period, whether it's short or long term. Now, I'm a pretty big advocate of holding real estate long term to create what I call generational wealth. But yeah, how do you raise investment dollars? You talk about it. It's not just going to magically appear one day in your mailbox. You have to go out and talk about it with your friends and neighbors and others who are like-minded. And you can look, if you do a simple search on the internet, there's all sorts of investment clubs out there you can join. But again, just like buying real estate, you want to be careful about which one you join. You know, you want to find out who the other players are. You want to have discussions with the other members, seeing whether they're of the same mindset. Because some people may want to buy real estate with the idea of renovating it or improving it and flipping it. Others may want to buy real estate with the idea of just buying it and holding for a long period of time. There's a lot of different investment strategies. And again, that goes all the way back to the type of investor you are and the type of real estate investments there are. So when it comes to raising investment dollars, look to yourself, look to your own savings, take a look at what equity you may have and what real estate you may own. You know, there are friends, there are families, and again, by pooling your resources, you'll be surprised what you can do. There are a lot of very young, successful real estate investors out there who started exactly that way by maybe pooling their funds with a couple of friends, maybe a couple of other family members, and buying real estate. That's the whole key. Talk about it. Join clubs. Do a little bit of research. It's there. It's accessible. If you're really looking for some more formal type answers, of course, we have our course. You know, our course is tailored specifically to those with little or no real estate investment experience. We talk about a lot of different issues and a lot of what we're talking about right now in maybe a clear, more concise manner, but it's an excellent way to get going. Familiarize yourself with the course. You know, take a look at the steps, see what options are available to you. I think that's probably the best bit of advice we can give any of our listeners. You know, we spent a lot of time, you know, I think we had two segments on property management, and one was about managing the property yourself, and the other was about choosing a professional management company. And common trends between the two all revolved around creating a team. In one instance, in the first, when you're managing the property yourself, you know, it's up to you to create your own team. And do you remember some of the members of any team? Do you remember, you know, some of the individuals that you needed to rely on, Bernie?
Actually, I do. It's you'll need an accountant. So someone's got to count the coin and make sure that you're compliant. Then you're going to need a lawyer to make sure that your transactions, your leases, or yep, license agreements, sure, whatever agreements between your clients and between your partners.
Absolutely. Those three are essentially, you know, the part of your initial team. Those are the people that you're going to rely on when you first enter into a co-tenancy, or even if there's no co-tenancy involved, those are the people you're going to rely on when you make your initial purchase. Other members of a good property management team still includes lawyers and still includes accountants. For sure, absolutely. But this is a great time to turn around and build your trades connections. For instance, your drywallers, your plumbers, your electricians, those people that do outside or inside maintenance, whether it's janitorial services you're looking for, or whether it's somebody to clear the snow or cut the grass. Anyways, all these people are members of your team. And the only way you're really going to be able to build that relationship and develop a really great group of people that you can rely on, especially when, you know, you really need them to be there, when you really need them to perform. Like, for instance, in cases of a plumbing emergency, you've got a frozen pipe, or, you know, there's an electrical issue, or maybe, you know, you're in a climate where there's a lot of snow. The only way to really kind of develop those relationships are, you know, word of mouth. I mean, talk to your neighbors, talk to your other partners, maybe someone has had a really tremendous positive experience with a tradesperson. Maybe it's an appliance repair person, or like I said, a drywall electrician, plumber, or general carpenter. You know, ask your other partners, you know, ask neighbors, ask people for referrals, because referrals are the number one way to get good quality service. You're taking a chance when you don't know who the individual is, and you're the individual that's going to have to vet the trade if you don't have someone else coming to you and saying, hey, look, use him. He's tremendous. I had a situation and he was there on time and his pricing was fair. I mean, that's invaluable. So seek out referrals. And once you find the right trades, just don't call them when you need them. You know, call them just to touch base, ask their opinion about any type of situation that may come up. If you've got a landscape maintenance company, for instance, and maybe you want to redo your walkway or plant some shrubs either by the road or closer to the house, call them up and say, look, what do you recommend? You know, what do you think is the best thing to do in this instance? They appreciate it. And you build a rapport, you build a personal relationship with them. And that's what it's all about. It's about relationships. So that really is probably the best way to build your team. And the one person we haven't spoken about here is your real estate agent. You know, your real estate agent can help you out tremendously when it comes to maybe leasing space, whether it's a commercial, maybe a retail plaza. And when it comes time to sell, if you want to sell, then maybe the real estate agent that's been with you for a certain period of time that knows your property, that you've shared your experience with, and maybe even the real estate agent that sold you the property in the first place, maybe he's the best source for you to go to when it's time to sell. So keep those things in mind. Remember, these people, property management, the number one overwhelming thing I'd like our listeners to take away, that the most important aspect of owning real estate is the management. Good management can make a property successful. Bad management can make a property a disaster. So remember, experience really buys you a large margin of comfort when it comes to property managing your investment. So keep that in mind. You know, again, good management can make or break any property. And it's the number one reason why properties fail, because they're not properly managed. But good management, great management, can take even the worst distressed property and really turn it into a work of art. So keep that in mind.
Well, it almost sounds like you don't want to embed them inside your investment club, too, as you're looking at prospective faces. And it kind of rolls in, like, from the professional management piece, and then we have the environmental piece, you know, the iceberg moment, right? You know, there's only so much you see above the ground, and then, you know, below the ground is like, wow, that's special. We talked about, like, having a team when you're taking over a property, whether it's sold and purchased straight from the original person or from the mortgage holder. So distressed properties. Are they a worthwhile venture, or are they just a harbinger of, gee, that guy, the previous guy or previous gal, as the case may be, had issues? And, you know, is it location, location, location? Is it, I've got spilt oil underground and I can't, you know, you as the person walking into that going, there are no problems, right? There are no opportunities. How should one view that? Obviously, you know, a neophyte, not so much so, but.
Well, you know, great question. Thank you. So distressed properties can be those that are functionally obsolete and are vacant in the case of an office building or a tower. And what's happening to a lot of these properties is that they're being repurposed, converted to residential units. which is a wonderful idea. And you're seeing a lot of larger development firms do just that, take some of these office buildings, which, you know, currently worldwide, you know, there's a pandemic in play. And what that has forced a lot of employers to do and a lot of employees to do is to start working out of their homes. Now, no one really knows at this stage of the pandemic what the actual effect is going to be on occupancy of some of these office buildings in the downtown core. But one thing is for sure, you know, the pandemic has shown that a lot of employees can function quite well working out of their homes. They don't necessarily need an office to go to. I'm not going to suggest to our listeners that the use of offices is going to disappear. That's not what I'm saying at all. But I think what you're going to see is the option given to a lot of employees as to whether they want to come into the office, you know, maybe 2-3 days a week, whether they want to come in at all. And because of that, what will end up happening is that the space requirements for a lot of these employers is going to lessen. So I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if you see in some instances companies reducing the amount of office space that they're using, you know, by 10, 25% quite easily, quite comfortably, because we've now learned to work effectively out of our homes. So what that means in essence is that you're going to see the buildings that are less desirable in the downtown core, like Class C buildings. Remember, you know, there are three different types or classes of office buildings, A, B, and C. And there isn't any set formulation as far as what these buildings may or may not have as far as amenities are concerned. It's very localized. So, for instance, in downtown Toronto or LA, you can have office towers that have, you know, the latest and greatest as far as HVAC units are concerned and high speed elevators and all the amenities, including electronic concierge service, built in health clubs. I mean, you name it, there's no end to it. It's amazing what some of these office buildings have actually become. You may have some of these buildings that are in that environment, a Class A building. You may also have in that same environment buildings that maybe don't have health facilities and high-speed elevators, but are still quite nice. Now, those buildings in that environment may be deemed a Class B building or maybe a Class C if it's a little older. But in a smaller metropolis, in a smaller area, that building that's a Class B or C in that LA environment could very well be a Class A building in another environment. So you need to be careful about classification. But getting back to what I see and what the reality is as far as occupancy rates are concerned in downtown cores of these larger office towers, what that means is that there's going to be more space available in some of these Class A buildings, the nicer buildings. And it's probably going to be made available at a better rate than what it was during pre-pandemic times. Not always the case. Again, it's very specific to the neighborhood and town or city that you live in. But at the end of the day, with less space being taken up by some of these larger corporations, what it means is that there's more room and more incentive for landlords to turn around and offer the excess space to maybe businesses and corporations that couldn't afford Class A space and were quite happy in a Class B environment. Anyways, this kind of trickles down. It doesn't take a great deal to understand that if you've got less demand for office space, but the landlords at the same time are incentivizing, you know, corporations and businesses to occupy their nicer buildings, what that means, it trickles down. So that I can see, and what's happened in a lot of these environments is that the Class C or the less desirable buildings, what's happening in them is that they're having, you know, vacancy rates that were unprecedented and unheard of before. So what that means when it comes to investing in that type of building, these type of properties, Class C office buildings, because they're not necessarily the less desirable and there's less of demand for it, and many of them are vacant, what that means is that the value of these properties has decreased substantially, because this is not a problem that's just going to disappear. It's the reality of the situation. There's less demand. You know, landlords, property owners are incentivizing, you know, businesses to come into their nicer premises, making it more affordable. That just means that the less desirable buildings are realizing much greater vacancy rates. So at the end of the day, if you're an investor, you can buy one of these properties for far less than you could have maybe 3, 4, 5 years ago, for the very simple reason is that they're much more difficult to lease and rent, and the occupancy rates are less for the very reasons that we discussed. However, there is a chronic shortage of housing, apartments available in downtown cores. And those type, because there is a great demand and there's very little supply, it means that these properties, residential, multi-unit residential buildings, are trading for cap rates that are historically never being lower. You have to understand that there's an inverse relationship between the value of a property and what the cap rate is. Many people initially, when they hear this, and this is really well explained and demonstrated in the course, there's a considerable amount of time that's devoted just to the entire topic of capitalization rates and evaluations. For that very reason alone, the course is an excellent, excellent investment if you have any ideas about investing in real estate. So at the end of the day, you've got Class C office buildings that have really decreased in value because there's far less of a demand, and they can be bought for cap rates that are much higher than what they were maybe, you know, again, 3, 4, 5 years ago, remembering that there's an inverse relationship. So the higher the cap rate, the less the value of the property. And that's something that a lot of people have difficulty understanding. Again, take the course. It's well worth it. At the tail end, the last type of investment, I feel, you know, should be included in that type of investment strategy is vacant land. Look, a great deal of money has been made through vacant land, but you need to have deep pockets, in the sense that vacant land produces, unless it's a parking lot, in which case the land is probably owned by a major development company, but vacant land produces no income. So even if you pay for the property in cash, you still have the ongoing expenses of property taxes and insurance to deal with. So that is a constant drain on your finances. So again, vacant land can be an excellent investment, but it's really for someone a little more established who maybe has cash flow coming from other resources, maybe other properties, other investment properties that they've purchased in the past. So as far as the plan is concerned, that's kind of how I see things, kind of for our average investor. That allows them diversification, and through diversification, it gives them a good balanced type portfolio and allows them to take advantage of, you know, the various market fluctuations without being unduly affected. You know, if you have all your assets mixed up in retail plazas, then what happens if all of a sudden, you know, like in this most recent pandemic, you're left with an overwhelming number of vacancies? Now, that's not always the case, but it does happen. So there may be things that happen outside of your control, which will affect your portfolio. By not having all your assets in one asset class, that will mitigate any negative influence, you know, outside circumstances may create. So that, as far as an investment plan, would probably be the way I would kind of deal with it. When it comes to individual assets, again, I'm a firm believer in having a plan and a mechanism in place to deal with the refurbishing and replacement of the principal assets. Now, you know, I say that keeping in mind that, you know, you're dealing, for instance, with a retail plaza. In those circumstances, most of those expenses, and we haven't really gotten into that, are picked up by the tenants themselves. But still, it's up to you as a manager, as a property owner, to make sure that, you know, they're well educated and they know well enough in advance when they may be called upon to replace, whether it's their HVAC unit or a portion of the roof. These are all things that you need to, you know, have some sort of working knowledge with. And that's just a sign of, you know, really good, strong, superior management style. So you should do that with every property.
So I guess having the business plan, having the building survey the current owner might have generated already, it will probably all help you towards getting your mortgage, right, through your broker. And this, I remember our conversation with Michelle Lalonde talking about mortgages, et cetera. What are the best terms to ask for your buying property? What's the, you know?
Oh, great question. Great question. I can only share with you, you know, my personal position on this. What I always like to do is maximize amortization, but I like my terms to be usually 5 years in nature, unless the interest rates have gone north like they did back in the late 80s, early 90s, which a lot of our listeners may not have ever experienced. But the ability to amortize a loan over a longer period of time also gives you room to improve cash flow and to also take the excess funds that you may have as a consequence of having a lower monthly payment and using those to pay down the principal. So at the end of the day, I can only share with you what I usually look for. In today's environment, as it has been for probably the past, you know, 5 years easily anyways, we're at historic lows when it comes to interest rates. So if available, I always suggest that what you do is you lock into a five-year term, depending on what your investment strategy is, depending on the type of investment. And one thing that we haven't spoken about are properties where you go in, you renovate, maybe subdivide, maybe create two units where there was one or redevelop and immediately put those units back on the market. Like we haven't even touched on that at all. But presupposing that is not your investment strategy, I believe the wise thing to do is to lock in to a longer term, 5 years, and use the maximum amortization available. Now, a lot of times, that is not going to be really an option that's left up to you. It's going to be dictated to by the lender. So you need to keep that in mind. And as Michelle so very clearly, you know, outlined, you know, different lenders will lend on different types of properties. Different lenders will present you with different terms. So it's not a situation where you can go in and dictate, but you may be given a number of different options, and it'll be up to you to choose the best option for what it is you want to do. So unfortunately, we're not in an environment, and we're seldom in an environment where we can dictate terms. But given the option, I always like in today's day and age, maybe if interest rates were to double sometime over the next 2-3 years, not that I'm suggesting they will, but if they were to double, I may not be so quick to tie in for a five-year term. Maybe I might look at something more along the lines of a three-year term. But keep in mind that very often you're going to be dictated to. You can shop around, and that's why, you know, it makes all the sense in the world to seek out someone like Michelle, because he's going to be best positioned to find the lender that's going to give you the best terms that are going to benefit you. Whether it's a redevelopment project where you plan on selling the asset once you've redeveloped it, or whether it's a long-term hold, it doesn't matter. He's going to be best in that position. So you can save yourself a whole lot of aggravation and time by going to an experienced mortgage broker, discussing with them what your plan is, and having them shop the paper for you, and then have them present to you the best options available.
So based on your experience of people involved in commercial real estate, especially those that are just starting out, what are the most common legal issues?
Well, that's a great question. Thank you. Probably the number one avoidable issue, Bernie, has to do with warranties that survive closing. And by that, and I'm just basing that on experience, that's where, for instance, a seller represents that the income is X number of dollars, when in reality, the income is X minus a questionable amount. Now, there are ways to ensure that that doesn't happen, you know, or it's a situation where someone has grossly understated, you know, the cost of, let's say, a rental component of the property, whether it's a furnace or multiple hot water tanks. And you really kind of see this in larger situations, larger buildings, you know, where, you know, a boiler system may be costing, in reality, you know, $400 or $500 a month on a rental or lease basis. You know, it was stipulated originally as costing $100 or $125. Now, that's avoidable by just asking for the necessary and supporting documents prior to its closing. We refer to those documents as due diligence materials. So what it means is that anytime you buy a property, you should be asking for the actual copies of the leases, whether it's commercial or residential, and copies of, for instance, any rental agreements for any equipment that may be on the property. It's very seldom that that involves out and out fraud. It's usually a mistake that's being made, but nevertheless, it can affect both the evaluation of the property and what the homeowner or property owner thought was going to be the cash flow. It doesn't happen too often that, you know, the cash flow is actually more than what was represented. It's usually because something has been misrepresented. Maybe you have a tenant who, you know, and this happens on commercial leases, maybe the lease stipulates that over the course of a five-year term, the tenant be granted 1 month free rent, basic rent, you know, for the first month of every renewed year, you know, on a calendar basis. And maybe that wasn't picked up by what we call estoppel certificates. You know, and you and I did have a discussion about estoppel certificates beforehand. All an estoppel certificate is, it's basically a document that is signed by both the tenant, commercial or residential, doesn't matter, and the landlord, which stipulates the term of their existing residency or occupancy, meaning that, you know, on this document, it says that the occupant is paying X number of dollars in rent. If it's commercial, there's usually a stipulation as to what the base rent is, and maybe some stipulation as to what the historical additional rent is. And remember, we have talked about this before, where commercial rent is usually broken down into two parts. You've got your basic rent and you have your additional rent. Additional rent is something that fluctuates every year, and it's basically there to reimburse the landlord the cost of operation of the building and the surrounding premises. So that's additional rent. So just like so many other things, it may be that your janitorial services have increased or your snow removal services have increased. Sometimes your utility payments for common elements have increased. Those are all aspects of additional rent. So anyways, an estoppel certificate essentially deals with, you know, your base rent in the case of a commercial lease and what your actual rent is in the case of a residential lease. So that's a very important document. Other issues that arise, you know, have to do with, for instance, you buy a property and the property, you know, lines aren't clearly spelled out, or, you know, maybe there might be a right of way over a portion of your land, or there may be a question as to whether the structure in the back is actually on your property or the neighbor's property. Now, it used to be a lot of those things were resolved, and we used to ask for a building location survey, which is not the same as a building survey per se, what we spent some time discussing earlier. A building location survey is actually a survey. It's what you used to see. It's a survey showing very often the surrounding properties and outlining where the fences are and the distances between the actual building and the property line. That's a building location survey. And that very much has kind of, I won't say disappeared, But today, and what we talked about with Mark, you're much more likely to see a property or a property owner or purchaser buying title insurance. And if you remember, we had quite a discussion about title insurance. And title insurance basically is there to insure the property buyer or purchaser against defects that may affect his title on the property. You know, for instance, there may be a fence that he wasn't aware of that he thought was his or is his that requires repair, you know, and if it didn't show up originally, you know, that may be a claim that a title insurance company may pay or may rectify. You know, I go back, we spent some time with the example of a property that we sold in the downtown core, which according to the rent roll and everything that could be found was a seven unit residential building in a very nice area, in an area of town where there were many, many buildings that were similar in nature, not all of them seven units. Some had three, four, five. It really kind of depended. But they were older buildings. And the buyer bought this building under the pretext that it was a seven-unit building. The realtor that was involved also believed it was a seven-unit building. And as part of the proof and part of the package, right on the property rent roll, on the assessment data, it had right on it seven-unit building. So you can imagine when the lawyer sent away to the local municipality a request for a zoning compliance report, when it came back, not as a seven unit, but it came back as a six unit right away. And the problem is that it was a relatively fast closing, and it's not uncommon sometimes for municipalities to be backed up to the point where they may give someone a verbal over the phone, but they won't issue the actual written report because it takes time. It takes time to produce. You need to actually have somebody do a physical search. So someone gave the lawyer the assurance that, yes, it was a seven unit according to the tax roll. But in reality, when the zoning compliance report came back sometime after the property had closed, it was discovered it was a six. So what title insurance did in that instance is they investigated the difference in evaluation between a seven and a six unit. Now, this was all in aid of protecting the buyer. The buyer had already bought and closed on this property, but he bought and closed the property on the basis that it was a seven unit. And the income derived by the seventh unit, which was never legalized and the building permit was never, ever issued for it, and hence there was no occupancy permit for it, it was never completed. So in order to protect the buyer's position, because he bought it as a seven unit, the title insurance company came back to him and said, well, there are two options. Either we can legalize the seventh unit, which was a lower level unit, effectively a basement unit, although it was more a half story type situation. We can legalize that, or we can pay you the difference between a sixth and a seventh unit. So after a considerable period of time, because it took quite some time for the, and this was all undertaken by the title insurance company, they actually sent a contractor in. They stripped down all the walls of the lower level unit to see exactly what they had to work with. They got cost estimates to actually rebuild that unit and do it in a fashion that was going to be recognized by the local municipality, in effect, legalizing the unit. And then they did a pretty exhaustive market survey. And this was something that, you know, again, our listeners haven't had the benefit of listening to Terry Egan, the appraiser that we're going to have on the show in the new season, speak. But it involves several different appraisers and several different estimates of value in order to try to determine the difference between a seven unit and a six unit, which was completely complicated further by the fact that the pricing for these units was fluctuating wildly. You know, it may have sold at one point in time for $300,000 a door, and now it was worth $400,000 a door. And just, again, not wanting to convolute or confuse our listeners, that is an aspect to buying multi-unit buildings, not necessarily either the correct way of evaluating a building, but it is a quick way of evaluating a building by evaluating it per door when you're talking about residential units. So there were wild fluctuations in not just the evaluation of the individual units, but as the building as a whole. And the cost estimates to actually legalize that seventh unit were such that at the end of the day, after an extended period of time, it took probably a year and a half to resolve the issue. It was decided by the title insurance company, who solely held the option on how to remedy the situation. It was decided by them that the least expensive thing for them to do would actually be to remove the seventh unit and pay the property owner the difference between the evaluation of a six and seven unit. So, you know, that was one aspect of the discussion with Mark that we spent a considerable period of time with, just talking about, you know, the legal issues, what can happen afterwards. But generally speaking, you can avoid all that by having a well-crafted agreement of purchase and sale on any purchase agreement, whether you're buying it individually or as a group. And usually time permits, when we're talking about commercial investment property, you should have it reviewed by your solicitor, by your lawyer. You know, that can avoid a lot of issues down the road. But a lot of the more common issues have to do with discrepancies when it comes to, you know, either the expense or rent roll. Sometimes, to a less extent, it has to do with property line disputes with neighbors. But again, that's something that title insurance can deal with. So you wouldn't want, for instance, today to buy a property without title insurance if it's available. It is a very, very smart insurance. Very important point to finish up our podcast with. So that's, I think, is a pretty good summation of what's happened during our first 12 podcasts. What do you think, Bernie?
Although I have experience in some areas in the real estate market and managing property, this has been even more of an eye-opener because, you know, some things you do know and there's some things you might not know. But what better way than to have subject matter experts kind of, you know, shed light on matters?
You know, just for those listeners that haven't listened through to a podcast before, we offer all our listeners and subscribers a $250 discount, which you can get when registering for our investment course, which again is specifically tailored for those with little or no real estate investment type experience. But don't let that fool you. There's a lot of aspects to the course that even someone who's more experienced can really benefit from. So you can get a $250 discount off the price by simply at checkout using the magic word podcast, all in capitals. Just put that in and your discount is immediate. So take a good look at it. There's a really great breakdown on the course information page, and look at, we'll be really happy to have you join a long list of alumni who have all taken the course. So if you have any questions, if you want to reach out to us, any questions pertaining to anything that you've heard today or anything that you've heard over the first 12 podcasts of The Property Wizard, please, by all means, what do you have to do, Bernie? Who do you reach out to?
It's info@gentryres.com. So info, I-N-F-O, at gentryres, GENTRYRES.com. All one word, gentryres.
Fantastic. Anyways, thanks for joining us today. This has been a really good exercise to do this and kind of catch up. We already have a real interesting season 2 in store for you. We have Terry Egan joining us. He's an appraiser and he's going to be talking about all things appraisal wise, what it is appraisers look for and what you should be looking for. And we also have Thomas Watson, who is another really interesting guest. And Thomas is going to speak to us about insuring your property. He's got a great perspective and it's a very, very informative session. So we've got a lot of other interesting guests and a great schedule of events coming up for you. So I want to thank you all for joining us on this season wrap-up. and look forward to speaking to you all in season two. And remember, Bernie, if there are no problems, there are
no opportunities.
Perfect. All right. Great. Thank you all for listening. Have a wonderful start to the new year.
Thanks for joining Freddie on another edition of The Property Wizard. Got a question? Ready to invest? Email info@gentryres.com. And if you'd like to find out more about the courses offered through Gentry Learning, visit gentryres.com. Until next time, remember, if there are no problems, there are no opportunities.